Okay, well, thank you very much. This is patterned, as Ray Williford indicated. There were a series of papers at the ASABE meeting in Minneapolis, and I fortunately scaled this down. Rick Baller did a good job discussion of some of the packaging, so mine is going to focus to a good extent on the bail itself. And by the way, I look at this as a framework, and I think we're going to find that there are a lot of gaps in there. And I'm also I'm betting that after this presentation, several of you say how I can fill in some of these gaps. But fundamentally, I'm looking at roughly around the turn of the other century, 1900. The bales on the left here, that was generally what they looked like. Roughly 500 pounds gross, relatively low density, whereas today, generally, everything in the U.S. is in the neighborhood of 28 pounds per cubic foot and 500 pounds net, even though there's some marketing statistics that call a bale 480 pounds. Ed Hughes showed the left-hand side of this bale press, which is a screw-type press. I think it's significant on the transport system there. There was a, where's the feeder for the lint coming in here, going up, they're dumping it into the hopper there, and then notice over here, taking the bales out of the press, as compared with and a whole host of new, more modern technologies. Prior to the bale itself, and by the way, a good deal of these references are out of a Tompkins Cotton and Cotton Oil, which is published in 1901, which gave a pretty good history of what I think of the cotton industry up to that point. But in the earlier gin houses, they'd simply cut a hole in the floor, hung a about a 3-foot sack in it, the best this description is, packed that probably by hand or by foot, and took that to market. That was probably more modern than what Ed showed you on some of the early, well, actually on some of the ginning going on in Mali, in which it went straight from one basket to the card to the spindle for the yarn. Later on, it became desirable to make a bale, 5 to 5.5 feet long, about 30 inches thick, and 40 to 40 inches, 48 inches wide. That's not too far from what the so-called flat bale was at the beginning of, at the beginning of this last half century. And this generally grew to be the standard size and shape of the bale. But there are a few things that happened in between there. The plantation bale, again, I think this is a variation of a slide that Ed Hughes showed you earlier, the modern screw press. And modern, that was in 1901, that was the modern press, producing what we today call, or recently called, a flat bale. But it was interesting that the modern gin, some of the more modern gins transported gin cotton to the screw press through metal ducts with air blasts created by the gin brushes and separated at a condenser, handling cotton from a whole battery of gins. Again, that's a sort of a summary of some of the things that Ed showed you. Also, after the Civil War, there were steam presses being used to press the cotton at some gins. Some of the presses operated under hydraulic pressure. Water or oil at 600 PSI on a 10-inch rim. I don't know what the densities were there, but my arithmetic says that that was not getting the really high densities that we anticipate today with a 600 PSI on a 10-inch rim. But that was a step toward modernization of the bale. Bale size and weight. What really characterized, how did we get the bale size that we have today? Well, the best we can tell, it was dictated by the body of the wagon that these were shipped in. By the description here, you lay them down, four of them on the bottom of this wagon. If you needed to add more, you add four more on top, and that was indicated. 10 bales was typically the limit for a team of six mules. And by the way, I understand the corollary to that, Ray, that the 40-inch row of cotton was based on the width of a mule and how you could walk down the rows with a mule. And so the density for shipping, the short hauling distances, the shorter the distance, the density is not particularly important. The longer shipping distances, say going from Mississippi and points west to the southeastern gins, you needed rail cars. It was not efficient to send a lot of air in the rail cars, so the indication is, well, let's get a higher density. The same for ships. In fact, going export even more important because you even needed a higher density bale. So there are a couple of variations that I know about. One, early on, high-density bale is something that we might characterize as a coffee table bale now, roughly 18 inches cube, 100 pounds, which most of us in here can, most of you in here could carry one, 30 pounds per cubic foot, about that density there. But seemed about the same time there was the round bale. A round bale, more modern, and by the description that I've seen in this area, there seemed to be conical rollers, if you can imagine rolling in a horizontal plane, which the best I can tell, the lint cotton was fed into this hopper here. It was compressed on a continuous basis here into a chamber with a compression. This is the best I can gather now, and some of you may have better information than this than I do, compressed into this chamber here to produce a bale, which is truly a round bale. In determining, you know, I did some quick calculation on this. This guy had three of these 250-pound bales, and I was looking at it to see if that's feasible. Well, actually, looking at the way he's got these positioned on this hand truck, he's probably lifting only about 60 or 70 pounds himself. So actually, you know, these seem reasonable. Also, another interesting aspect that I picked up at the last meeting, Kelly Green told me that these round, and Tony Williams also verified this, so it must be right, that the Texas cotton ginners around the 1900s, there was a big controversy within the Texas Cotton Ginners Association about this round bale. There was one particularly important line company, ginning company, who, a ginners, not the manufacturers, who were really promoting this round bale for efficiency purposes. And if I understand it, it either totally or almost split the Texas Cotton Ginners wide open to the point that it was illegal to produce a bale, a round bale, until about, I think, 1910 or 1913, in that range. So, and this photo was, this was a Memphis warehouse with those round bales. So, it appeared that the cylindrical and this small cubical bale did not get any traction. But there was a significant effort, as I indicated, to promote the round bale. And the best we can tell, the best I can tell, is somewhere between 1915 and 1924, the cotton bale was standardized. And I put quotes around that. I don't know if that was an official standardization, but that seemed to be the target of the size and shape of these bales. The flat bales were shipped directly to cotton mills. Now, this is the more modern 500-pound flat bale. But if they're going longer than a few hundred miles, they were recompressed now at the warehouse steam compress. Now, the density, there were two choices on this recompressed density. There was roughly a 23 pounds per cubic foot, which the domestic mills would accept. And if you were, again, producing cotton in Mississippi or points westward, that was an optimal, it seemed to be an optimal shipping density by the rail cars getting to the southeast. But if you're going to over the ocean, they were producing high density bales, which are 30 to 32 pounds per cubic foot. So and I'm not going to get into all of these, but fundamentally, you're taking a flat bale of roughly 12 pounds per cubic foot from the gin, recompressing that to roughly half of its size into the what's called a standard density bale. And then, if you happen to change your mind and then get a market for this, it was recompressed again to putting pressure in the other direction also. So now the difference is, for some reason, the foreign textile mills would deal with this bale, even though it was did not open up, didn't fluff it up. The U.S. mills would not accept this bale, so that was a dilemma. So a little bit of process, and this was still going on early on in my career, which is only about 100 years ago, where the flat bales would go into what was called, it was a temporary press or a low-pressure press called a Nicky press, which the tires were taken off. The bale then was transported simply by its cover and some wires hooked into the side of this to keep it from coming apart most of the time. And by the way, testimonials are that a high press compress could press 120 of these bales per hour. I never saw it and I never believed it, but I was told that to be true. Looking on the inside of this high density press, these are the so-called doors. These would come up and put the side pressure, depending on how much pressure you could stand on the side of the bales. And of course, this what's some called follow block, platter in some cases, platen in other cases. This would come up to anywhere from 9 to 11 inches in a very short time. There were testimonials that air would come out so fast that it would split the cotton. Well, and they call them air cuts. I doubt that it was air. It was probably differential pressure causing shear cuts. But anyway, it would literally cut big holes in the inside of the bale. By 1970, there were roughly five different densities and shapes and types of bales in the U.S., creating some inefficiencies because of the non-standardization. The industry decided that, well, why don't we compromise on a standard bale? Since the word standard is already used, let's call it a universal density bale. The universal density, all bales would have a common density. Ideally, there would be what's called a compressed universal density, then a gin universal density. That required some doing. If you can imagine, at that time in the U.S., there's probably still around 4,000 or 5,000 gins, in which each gin must have some modification to from a flat bale to a what they call a modified flat bale. They would decrease those by putting shims on the inside of the doors and inside of the press box. Shims being 2x6s, 2x8s. Or two by somethings, wooden shims in which a couple of 3 years of hand-wringing and experimentation, most of the industry, except the Southeast, because they didn't feel like they needed to because of the short distances to the domestic mills, this was accomplished. And also, all of the compresses removed the side pressure to the point that we were producing nominally 28 pounds per cubic foot bales. This is a schematic of the two bales. On the left is a gin universal density bale. On the right is a compressed universal density bale. The commonality here is the external dimensions were roughly the same. It just so happened that the area direction of compression was different, but for shipping purposes, this bale was somewhat the same. So, actually, that's the one I thought I was talking about. But anyway, today, I would say, with very, very few exceptions, 100% of the bales in the U.S. are, I would say, gin density. Now, gin universal density today can range anywhere from 24 to 28 pounds per cubic foot. But nominally, we've got the same density bales, which are accepted by all of the mills which we are either exporting to or shipping to. Real quickly on some bale packaging, I'm not going to get into packaging issues, but the interesting thing here that back until around 1968, bales of cotton were traded on the gross weight. So that was a really good incentive to have the heaviest bagging and ties that you could have. Ostensibly, there were 21 pounds of jute and steel, not 12 pounds of jute, 9 pounds of steel with bands and buckles. I got a minute and 35 seconds and I'll finish it up. My arithmetic says that if you start off with 500 pounds gross, that leaves 479. We like to round things, so 480 pounds became our statistical bale. That's where we came up with the, still call it the 480-pound bale. So, but problem is, with gross weight trading, there was no incentive for innovation on packaging, strapping materials. It's very difficult to automate those old systems. It thwarted new technology, delayed automation to the point that around 1968 to 71, I think it officially in 71, the industry shifted from gross weight trading rules to net weight trading, which meant that you would weigh the bale, subtract the tear, and as Shea Simpson and Dale Thompson know, people still fuss about the tear. They want one tear, they would like 21 pounds because the arithmetic is easy on it. But anyway, the farmers complained that they were being cheated out of those 21 pounds of cotton, so the loan was actually adjusted to account for that to provide the transition. We had an economist at the National Cotton Council till the day he left back in the 80s. He still complained that the farmers took it in the ear because they never really got paid for it. That's what he believed. But anyway, today, not to get into the how we got there, but there are at least a couple of people in this room who've spent a good bit of their more than a couple, good bit of their career working to develop the improved bagging materials, the woven polypropylene, the polyethylene film, burlap, the wire, the plastic PET strapping materials. So with that, that's the evolution of the cotton bale. And you turned me off at 30 seconds, so I can go on forever, right? Okay, well, thank you very much.